You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are in the old Talbot Inn.
Ye olde Talbot Inn.
Which would have been pronounced the old, I think, back in the day. Medieval pronunciation police intervening here. The old Talbot Inn in Worcester. We will be on stage in 4 hours' time at the Huntingdon Hall. This is no use to anyone listening to this, because by the time you listen to this, we'll have been on stage and come off again. But we are midway through the first half of our Grand Tour of Britain. Two nights down, three to go this week. Dublin tomorrow, Belfast on Friday. Still tickets available if you want to come along, although I think very, very close to sold out in Belfast on Friday.
You should have said Britain and Ireland, of course, Lionel. Grand Tour of Britain and Ireland. But yeah.
Or if you're going to be really pedantic, UK and Ireland, because someone would say Belfast isn't Ireland, so that's debatable. So UK and Ireland is better.
Anything further to add to that, Francois? My name's Richard Moore. That was Lionel Burney and birthday girl Orla Shinawee, and we're with Francois Thomaso as well.
Yes, I'm here.
Wonderful. Oh, brilliant. Excellent.
Is there any sense that the evening performances are kind of sapping our daytime energy a bit? I don't know. We're putting so much into it.
I think you'll all be proud of us, because, I mean, 4 hours before the show, we're in a pub, a very nice pub, and, you know, and it's kind of puzzling, because Richard's having a Coke, Lionel is having coffee, Orla is having still water, and I'm having a kind of Perrier. So I mean, we're gearing up for the show. You know, no booze or anything. Don't believe the signed podcasts on tour are wild. We're just being very reasonable.
Very clean living. And one of the reasons for our tour, and before we carry on with this week's episode, with lots of news to discuss in this week's episode, not least the ongoing hearing for Dr. Richard Freeman in Manchester. We'll get some reaction from somebody who was at Shane Sutton's kind of bombshell testimony on Tuesday. Raymond Poulidor has died. We heard about that today. We'll hear from Francois on Poulidor a bit later on. But we're launching our book this week, The Grand Tour Diaries. It was published on Monday. One thing we should say is that it's not going to be available on Amazon if you're waiting to buy it on Amazon. We've kind of published it ourselves, so it's available at thecyclingpodcast.com. If you click on book, that will take you to the page where you can buy copies of the book. £15, you can post anywhere. Great Christmas present. Not too early to buy Christmas presents. It's our diaries from the 2018 and 2019 Grand Tours and Women's Tour. And we are, as Lionel said, midway through our first week of our tour. We've got shows coming up in London, then Leicester, Cambridge, Edinburgh and Manchester. We're going to be joined in London next week by Matt White, the following week by Adam Blythe, and a new guest, Rod Ellingworth, the new boss at the Bahrain Merida team. He will be joining us on the 25th of November, and Adam Blythe will be joining us again in Manchester on the 30th of November. Tickets available at thecyclingpodcast.com. But before we get into some of the stories, Lionel, have you got a news roundup for us?
I have indeed. Well, Richard, you mentioned Raymond Poulidor, who has passed away at the age of 83. He was, of course, nicknamed the Eternal Second. We'll get Francois's thoughts on that particular nickname in a little while. But Poulidor rode 14 editions of the Tour de France and finished 12 of them. He was second 3 times and third 5 times, including in his final tour, which he rode at the age of 40. He was unfortunate in that his career coincided with those of the 2 5-time winners, Jacques Anquetil and Eddy Merckx. The only Grand Tour that Poulidor won was the Vuelta in 1964. He also won Milan-San Remo, but I suppose for cycling fans out there, you may well have seen Poulidor in arguably the most iconic photograph of cycle racing ever taken, really, or certainly one of them. The moment on the Puy de Dôme in the 1964 Tour de France, where he and Anquetil literally came shoulder to shoulder. If you Google that, you'll be able to see what I'm talking about. It's a really spectacular image. Poulidor was also the first rider to undergo an anti-doping test at the Tour de France in 1966. Maybe Francois will have a bit of information on that. And despite the fact that he never wore the Tour de France's yellow jersey in his long career, he in recent years and for quite a long time was an ambassador, brand ambassador for Credit Lyonnais, the bank that sponsored the yellow jersey. And so every day at the Tour we would see Poulidor in a yellow polo shirt. I wrote in the Grand Tour diaries about how, you know, I thought that was almost a sort of slightly sideways tribute to Poulidor, really, making him wear a yellow polo shirt every day at the Tour, despite the fact he never actually pulled on the maillot jaune. He has a very direct link to modern day cycling, and in fact future cycling, because he is the grandfather of Mathieu van der Poel, the current sensation, because his daughter Corinne married Adrie van der Poel, the Dutch rider and Mathieu van der Poel's father. Poulidor had been unwell since last month and he passed away in hospital in his hometown, San Leonard de Nobla. So sad news, and one that really, we gather from Francois, has created big waves in the French media with lots of tributes. So sticking with French cycling, Romain Bardet has announced, directly as a result of Francois' contribution to the Grand Tour diaries, I suspect, that he is going to ride the Giro d'Italia next year. We'll get Francois' thoughts on that a little bit later. Bardet also took part in a cyclocross race in his hometown Brude at the weekend, but he only got 500 metres into the race before he had a problem with his handlebars. I think his handlebars snapped, and that was his race over. Another unfortunate incident happened at the Ghent 6 last night. Mark Cavendish is racing there with the Ghent favourite Ilho Kaiser. Cavendish crashed, or his wheels went from under him in the flying one lap time trial. So he missed the first Madison of the night, but we got back on his bike later on. Harry Tanfield has signed for AG2R. He rode for Katusha this year. Dimension Data has rebranded as NTT Pro Cycling for next season and has unveiled a dark blue and black jersey. Looks a bit Team Sky-like, the new jersey for the NTT team. The Cyclocross European Championships were at the weekend, a Dutch double with Mathieu van der Poel retaining his title, making it three in a row, and Yara Katalin dominating the women's race from start to finish, really. And finally, Christian Dudasek. He has been handed a four-year ban. You may remember he was one of the riders caught in the Operation Adalas, the bloodletting doping investigation centering on Austria and Slovenia. But the big news of the week is this ongoing medical tribunal into the conduct of Dr. Richard Freeman, the former Team Sky and British Cycling doctor, and we'll talk about that in this episode.
The fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Thank you very much to Rafa, our title sponsor. Very grateful to them for their support. Hope to see some people from Rafa at the shows in London, possibly Manchester too. And, the Pedlar, Ducharme Pedlers, Ducharme T-shirts form part of our on-stage set, don't they? Still available at rafa.cc, along with lots of other nice items of clothing. We're going to talk in this first part about the Richard Freeman case, which is on arrest day today. but we're speaking a day after. Unfortunately, we were following it from afar. We will hear in a moment or two from Tom Carey, our colleague at the Telegraph, cycling correspondent at the Telegraph, who was there in the room when Shane Sutton appeared. And as a witness for the GMC, the General Medical Council, he was questioned by Mary O'Rourke, Richard Freeman's QC. And, well, the headline really was that she described him as a doper, a serial doper and a liar, and she really riled him, it appears, and it was a pretty ill-tempered exchange where Shane Sutton turned back on Mary O'Rourke and accused her of being a bully when she accused him of being a bully. She read out some text messages, including one from last week that he had apparently, allegedly sent to Richard Freeman, saying, "Be careful what you say. I can drag you in. You won't be the only person I can hurt." Which was pretty damning on Shane Sutton. He eventually stormed out, having threatened to leave. He stormed out. We gathered today he will not appear on Thursday as he was originally scheduled to do. And you feel that he hasn't really been asked the questions that presumably Freeman's team were going to put to him, which is feels like a missed opportunity. Steve Peters, who was the head of medicine at the time, will appear instead. But I think it feels like an opportunity has been lost a little bit to really ask Shane Sutton some of the most pertinent questions.
Yeah, especially when we read, you know, some of the subjects that came up seemed to me to be totally unconnected and irrelevant to this. You know, did Shane Sutton know the amateur rider Dan Stevens and the dubious doctor Mark Boner? And really, when you've got the former head of performance of British Cycling, Shane Sutton, there giving evidence, somebody who was so deeply involved in Team Sky, particularly in the period leading up to and after Bradley Wiggins winning the Tour de France, you know, really integral figure, it did feel a little bit like a lost opportunity to ask some direct, specific questions about the culture and events of that period. It seemed to focus more on Sutton's character, and I do understand that in a case like this it's about establishing trustworthiness, reliability and so on, but if that has been at the expense of actually hearing some proper evidence, then I think that is an opportunity wasted. But the actual drama of the whole hearing, Orla and I have been talking about our sort of dim and distant past covering court cases, and that frisson of drama and excitement when you see the kind of the QCs cross-examining or questioning the people who've been brought to provide witness testimony, it is dramatic. And just the picture in my head of Richard Freeman sitting behind the screen because he didn't want to be visible to Shane Sutton, and reading the transcripts as they were being published on Twitter. I mean, following the case in almost real time on Twitter was quite a thrilling experience yesterday afternoon, especially as you witnessed kind of Sutton's losing his rag and melting down, and the twin attack on Freeman, you know, on the one hand saying you were a very good friend and a really good doctor, and then on the other hand calling him a coward effectively and asking for him to take the screen away. I think you learned a lot more about Shane Sutton's character from that day or that afternoon than we actually have done about either the testo gel delivery or the general ethos, conduct and so on at British Cycling and Team Sky.
Well, let's hear from somebody who was in the room and did witness exactly what went on. Tom Carey from The Telegraph. Well, Tom, you were in the room when Shane Sutton was being questioned during the tribunal into Richard Freeman. Can you describe how Shane came across and you know, the moment at which he seemed to become angry and finally lose his temper and storm out?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty early, really. I think this, you know, tensions were already running quite high because Mary O'Rourke, who's the QC, who is representing Freeman, had already told us, or told the tribunal in the morning, what she was going to put to Shane, which was fairly explosive, and she knew, I think it was pretty cute what she did there. You know, she knew that would be reported around lunchtime and that wind would have got to Shane about that. And I think she was fairly confident that was going to rile him, and she was dead right, really. I mean, she knew that he hadn't performed brilliantly at the DCMS inquiry a couple of years ago, and that he is quite a volatile character, and it took him absolutely no time to you know, take issue with the allegation that he doped in his career and that he was a serial liar, etc. And he was straight in there, you know, ignoring her questions and just, you know, taking her on that point and starting to rant. And more than once he felt that, you know, he might do what he eventually did, which was to get up and walk out. But he, you know, they managed to sort of, you know, he was sort of, just to paint the scene a bit, he was sort of sitting with his back to us, to the gallery, looking, and there was a real sense of theatre about it because he was looking straight at the tribunal panel, and to his right there were his lawyers for the GMC, and to the left there was a screen, and you couldn't really see Mary O'Rourke or Freeman, who we presume was sitting behind the screen, but none of us could see him, or we never heard from him. So there was this sort of strange, you know, they were just feet away from each other, but you know, he wasn't able, and we weren't able to see Freeman at all. So at various points during the tribunal, he would start addressing Dr. Freeman directly. He would start saying, "Richard, just take the screen down. Take the screen down, man, and look me in the eye." You know, he was really starting to lose it. And they, you know, they kept saying, you know, just keep on message, answer the questions, etc. And you know, he was unable to do that ultimately. And yeah, it just built up. They did take a little recess at one point, a sort of 10-minute break, to while Sutton went out and had a fag, and then he came back in and quickly got worked up again. And that was when he got up and stormed out. It was extraordinary. I've never seen anything like it.
What's the upshot of it? You know, I mean, it seems that Mary Rook wanted to rile him. That's the impression. But did she manage to get all the questions to him that she would have wanted to put to him? Presumably not.
No, I mean, she said in the morning very clearly that she wanted a day and a half. She'd need a full day and a half to get through her list of questions, which she had, you know. She said she had 27 pages of notes planned, and you know, she was going through them, you know, one by one. So we were, you know, he was booked to come back in on Thursday, which he's now not going to do. So presumably she didn't. But then again, I think her goal, as you said just then, was to rile him, and you know, her intention was to discredit him as a character and to paint him as an unreliable person and as a bully. And in the sense that he got himself worked up and, you know, eventually, you know, stormed out of the hearing, shouting at Freeman that he was spineless. You know, she may feel that she got her point across to the tribunal. But it was, yeah, it was pretty extraordinary. I mean, at one point, just to add to that, it just occurred to me, on his way out, he sort of paused at the door and said, you know, to the press and everyone, you know, we were all sort of standing there, you know, open-mouthed a bit. There was the, you know, UCAD had their officials there, British Cycling had their legal representatives, and everyone was just, you know, sitting there a bit stunned. He said, "I've got nothing to hide, you know, you guys can come and speak to me outside." And so there was a sort of, undignified stampede to get outside and speak to him. And then everyone was standing outside on the steps outside St. James's Building in Manchester, and after about 20 minutes, he hadn't come out, and it occurred to everyone that he might have gone back into the hearing, because the tribunal chair had been saying that, you know, he was going to try and convince him to come back in and finish his testimony. So then there was this, you know, the decision as to whether to go back up. It was just one of those bizarre days where no one, I mean, they'd completely lost control. I don't think they're used to the, you know, that sort of high-profile hearing. They, you know, I imagine they're fairly more, you know, more usually, you know, fairly quiet medical misconduct hearings without the world's press in attendance. So yeah, it was a very strange day.
So that was Tom Carey there, fresh from his dramatic day at the GMC tribunal. Shane Sutton, and that obviously has been the big story. It's all about Shane Sutton, and it's not, it's kind of moved away from Richard Freeman and what the case is about, which is about his conduct, his, you know, it's about kind of mundane things like record keeping as well. I say mundane, obviously important for a doctor to keep accurate records. But from a cycling point of view, and this is what we talked about last week, you know, the interest of people who follow cycling is really centres on this delivery of Testogel. What was it for? Who was it for? And, you know, I mentioned, I tweeted this this week as well about Freeman, that a couple of years ago when I worked on a BBC documentary about British Cycling, Team Sky, and some of the controversies around them at the time, we met with Richard Freeman a couple of times, and he was willing to come on and be interviewed, and then not willing, kept changing his mind. But we had lengthy conversations with him, and what was most clear was his fear of Shane Sutton, visceral fear. He felt he'd been bullied by him, but also close to him at times, and you know, I think we can see that even in what Shane said in the room yesterday, that, you know, he was on the one hand sort of paying tribute to him, and on the other hand being quite unpleasant towards him. And it was quite striking, really, the hold that Sutton seemed to have over Freeman when we spoke to him a couple of years ago.
And in that sense, Mary O'Rourke, Dr. Freeman's QC, has done a very good job, actually, because while the media attention has been around Shane Sutton and the drama and the theatrics and the almost farcical nature of yesterday and him storming out, that's not going to take away from the hearing itself, because we can make all the noise that we like, but actually they're very used to dealing with the bread and butter and the meat and veg, or however you want to say it, of these actual cases. And part of what she had to prove was that he wasn't, A, I guess that he wasn't reliable necessarily as a witness, but also that he did have this hold over Freeman and that he was able to turn in the way that Freeman would have suggested. And what he displayed in court yesterday was very classic bullying behaviour, where he said that he's a good guy, he's a friend of mine. Richard, take down the screen, let me look you in the eye, be a man about it, and getting more aggressive and calling him spineless at the end. That is part of what she had to establish. Now, it was a missed opportunity in a sense, because she kind of known that he was going to walk out halfway through. But as you say, Lionel, we've covered a lot, and we've all covered lots of court cases in our time, and that is part of cross-examination, where you've got to build the scene, you've got to set the scene, you've got to set the witness up, and you have to rile them to be able to get to the important matters. And it is important to say that he did deny that the test of gel was for him, and that's what she needed to get. She needed to get that answer out of him, whether he'd ordered it or not. We can say we all knew he was going to deny it anyway, but you've got to trust in the process of this system. And she does have that denial on record. So she's done a lot of what she had to do, but in terms of a wider culture, and what we all want as journalists on the outside, trying to get a better idea of the culture within British cycling, that's not been answered. But I'm not sure how pertinent that is to Freeman's actual fitness to practice case.
I think that's exactly right. Mary O'Rourke's job there is not actually to find out all of the things that we want to know. Her job is to defend her client as best as possible. And so you're absolutely right, especially when this has not got quite the same power of a criminal court case. Shane Sutton is not compelled to return, whereas if you were in upper, if you were called to give evidence in a court case, you would have to come back until the judge is satisfied. So that's what I meant by the sort of the sense from our point of view, it feels like a missed opportunity, because we want to know the fundamental facts of what went on, and who the testo gel was ordered for, how it came to be delivered to British Cycling headquarters, what happened to it. They are questions that do have to be satisfied at some point, and at the moment this feels like the best way of achieving that, and unless of course UK anti-doping take this on after this hearing is concluded.
Francois, how's this playing in France and elsewhere?
There's been a rather long story in L'Equipe yesterday about it, but more on the grounds that, look what a mess Team Sky or Team Ineos, have been and have become, and the success story and everything that's been kind of riled as well, and you ride in France, Chris Froome and other, Team Sky riders were not very popular on the tour for quite a while, and it kind of this story kind of goes to comfort the guys who don't like Team Sky in France in the impression that behind the scenes, behind the success story, it was not such a big happy family after all, and really for the image of the team and what's been achieved by the team, to have that this kind of scenes and this kind of exchange of words and phrases like serial liar and doper. I mean, it's the I think the impact on the image of Team Sky has been for the past three or four years damaged, but this is not doing it any good at all. Now back to the story itself. I don't think it's the role of this panel, unfortunately, Lionel, to get into the their role is to decide whether Richard Freeman as a doctor has misbehaved or not. And maybe the way Mary O'Rourke was, maybe she did a great job, but showing the baddie in the story is Shane Sutton. But now there's another hearing on Thursday, and there's no scapegoat. Now it'll be Richard Freeman against the panel, and maybe she should have taken a little bit more time to rule out Shane Sutton out of the way, because now it's Richard Thursday, that's tomorrow, with Richard Freeman on his own against the panel, and that maybe we will get to know a little bit more. I don't know.
Well, Steve Peters as well has been called as a witness for the GMC, a very different character to Shane Sutton. I don't imagine him storming out. But I think the one thing that's been hinted at is that they've asked, that's Freeman's team, have asked for this affidavit that the Daily Mail apparently have, which has been signed by Shane Sutton, and she never got to that and got to what's in that, and that seems clearly to be important to this case. It might just be about Shane's character and his trustworthiness. The rumour is, the suggestion is that what's in that contradicts what he said to the DCMS in the House of Parliament, which could land him in hot water. I don't see the Daily Mail giving up this affidavit. As you say, Francois, it's not a court, so the powers are kind of limited. But, you know, it's for anybody following this story or who has followed the story, and I've said for a long time now that a lot of this, all the Jiffy backstory, everything, a lot of it, I think, boils down to people falling out, Richard Freeman and Shane Sutton in particular, the circumstances around Shane Sutton's departure from British Cycling, the aftermath of that, Richard Freeman's role with Jess Varnish, for example, and there were other, you know, reasons for him and Shane Sutton to fall out. And I think that will, some of that will come to light eventually, somehow or other. But we're not going to get that now from Shane in this hearing.
Chute, chute de l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
We need to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by Lacca. Lacca, who are they, Lionel?
Well, Richard, Lacca is a smarter way of insuring your bikes and gear. It's a community of cyclists joining together to play fair and take good care to save each other money. Lacca covers all the basics: theft, accidental loss and damage, both at home and abroad. It also covers cyclists in sportives and races, as long as they're not riding in the pro peloton. Instead of charging you a fixed premium each month or each year, you only pay a small share of the community's claim costs. So your share is proportionate to how much you insure with Lacca. While your share can theoretically go down to £0 a month if there are no claims, Lacca also locks in a maximum price to make sure there are no nasty surprises. So even in months with lots of claims, your premium can't go above a certain amount. Claims are also accepted fast, usually within a day of making a claim. But don't take our word for it. Let's hear from one of Lacca's customers.
So I had my bikes insured on my home insurance. Well, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. I've never really had a great experience with any insurer. It's always been really difficult. Also, with my home insurance, it was much more expensive. I also concerned that should I need to make a claim, even if it wasn't a huge claim, you worry about the value of making the claim compared to the impact it will have on your future insurance. I'm Philip Meyer. I've been a Lacca customer since about April 2018. I insure my two bikes, my son's bike and my wife's bike with Lacca. Well, I think they had a really unusual business model, and that's something else that did draw me to them, is that they're approaching it from very different approach. It was almost a peer-to-peer insurance model, which I thought was unique. I mean, I've never heard of anyone else doing this, and frankly wish I'd thought of the idea. There is a pool of people who are insured. You only pay when someone makes a claim, and I thought that was really, really good policy. Also, it's in their interest. They only make money when they pay out claims, which is the exact opposite to the insurance industry. It's not in their interest to pay out claims. So I really like the concept there. They cover the full value of my bikes. I feel very confident, having had a claim with them, that I'd have nothing to worry about, that if there's a problem, that they'll pay that out straight away.
Lacca's members have saved 61% on their bike insurance bills, and that's money that could be spent on a new piece of kit or put towards a training camp trip. So if you want to find out more about Lacca, go to lacca.co.uk. That's lacca.co.uk.
So, Francois, sad news to wake up to this morning. Raymond Poulidor, you know, not a young man, certainly, but he was very much present at the Tour de France, even this year's race. He was there every day in the village, very recognisable figure. You know, famously, his great rival was Jacques Anquetil, who died in 1987. And there's a great story, or, you know, famous story about Poulidor visiting Anquetil on his deathbed, and Anquetil saying, "I've beaten you again, Raymond," or words to that effect. So he's, you know, he had a long life, and he was extremely popular. And I guess for somebody who never even wore the yellow jersey and may have regarded his, you know, his career or his record in the Tour as almost a series of failures, he ended up being one of the most celebrated cyclists in history.
It was, it's difficult to imagine. I mean, as we were discussing that, I mean, it amounts for a Brit, for to Bobby Charlton dying. You know, well, okay, Bobby Charlton won the World Cup in 1966, but
I didn't know that.
there's a twofold story, you know, in that, because you must bear in mind that you had Pulido and you had Anquetil, and they go together. It's a kind of a that's a little bit what's missing in cycling these days, and might be what the reason why Chris Froome you know is not as popular as it could be, because maybe apart from the year when he rode the tour with Bradley Wiggins, there's never been that rivalry that went on forever. You know, Federer and Nadal would say Coppi Bartali, even you know Bahamontes, Ordoño. There was lots of little rivalries like that in various countries, and really the story of Raymond Poulidor was for a long time the story of that rivalry between, you know, the elegant, stylish, kind of upper class posh, as all I might say, Anquetil, and the guy from the countryside, the guy from the you know the humble guy who worked hard to get there, and it happened in the 60s at a time when really rural France against you know urban France were kind of, you know, facing one another. And the problem we see today, I mean, it's all over the place, the insiders, the outsiders, you know, the small town people, and the great divide between, you know, these, it already existed in the 60s, and Raymond Poulidor embodied that image of a France that there's always been a misconception that France loved Raymond Poulidor because we would have some kind of a romantic craving for losers, but it's not the case. Poulidor was very popular because he started from nothing. He had to work hard and almost got there, but in the end, it's impossible. You're blocked, and that's the impression lots of, you know, French people today with the Gilets Jaunes or others have. Like, they work hard, they do their best, they go very, almost to the top, but they can't get to the 1%, you know, they can't break that class barrier, and that's the thing that really made Poupou such that there was, I mean, there were words created for him, like you know, Antoine Blondin was a famous journalist writing for L'Équipe on the Tour. He created that word popularity, you know, it was because that really was it. And Poulidor had become in France a real word, like you would say so-and-so is the Poulidor of French politics, or so-and-so is the Poulidor of French chanson, or, you know, it became the symbol of the you know, second best, the runner-up. It's a little bit unfair, as Lionel pointed out. He won, I think, nearly 150 races in his pro career. He won La Vuelta, he won Flèche Wallonne, Milan-San Remo, Paris, lots of races. And once again, the record holder of podium finishes on the Tour de France. I know, well, there's not that many riders who could, you know, be seen and presented as losers when you've won so much. But yeah, everything about that humility, his face. I mean, it was the 60s. I mean, the look of these guys. I was looking at the pictures this morning. The way, you know, the faces. I mean, they made, you have the impression riders were made were from different breed in that era, with their, you know, they don't make them like this anymore, you know. They're even Bahamontes or Poulidor, Anquetil. I mean, it's not like the haircut or the hairstyle or something. They came from another era, which is quite. I mean, when we're on tour here at the Grand, you know, the Cycling Podcast Grand Tour, we've got these Molteni jerseys. You all know, you know, listening to the podcast, how the jersey from the period, the bikes, everything around it, all the paraphernalia is so romantic. And Poulidor was at the very heart of all this. So today, I was reading the press. I mean, President Macron and all my friends on the very, you know, various social networks from all kind of backgrounds. They're all mourning that guy because he belongs to our culture. He belongs to what our parents were. With all and his career spans for so long in a way, because he was third in the last tour at the age of 40, so which is something, and. That it really belongs to you know, is a household, not only name, is a household figure. I mean, everybody, as you say, even last year on the tour, you know, I've got my little mascot, which I call Doraemon Poulidor, and I managed to have him hold it for a picture. It was like the Michelin Man, you know. He really belongs to the image of France. So yeah, it's a great loss for the national psyche, I guess.
Yeah, I think, well, Daniel on Twitter, not here with us on the first part of the Grand Tour. I mean, very unconventional. He's joining us for Stage 7, but, I mean, that's the way Daniel does.
Do you think it is a Mallorca challenge?
Yeah, exactly. But he made a comment about Poulidor's, you know, physical appearance and stature, really. Not a tall man, even, you know, as a young man, but... you're absolutely right, Francois, and Daniel as well. Just seem to be built from something, made from something, you know, a little bit different. Sort of, you know, leather skin, you know, big sausagey fingers, sort of, you know, legs made of oak. It's just sort of solid, honest material.
Sturdy. He looks sturdy. You couldn't imagine him, you know, finishing on the podium of the tour now, because he was quite thick set almost. And again, there was that contrast with Anquetil, who was so elegant and graceful and long limbs and beautifully coiffured hair. You know, Poulidor also looked different. He was a contrast.
You know, in a way, was made of the same material. You know, that's all this history of you know, well, guy from the farm. You know, guys from the farm. You know, riding their bikes and becoming riders. I mean, his physique, apparently, the legend says, might be the reason why he was always second or third on the tour, because apparently when he was when he was making toxins, you know, when he was his body was struggling, apparently his skin color changed to kind of greenish gray, and all his rivals knew that, and when they saw, oh, look at Poo, his skin is turning, you know, copper again, and that's when they attacked him. So I don't know what's true with it, but I mean, it might be, it might be right. I mean, I heard that a couple of times from guys from the time.
I mean, he was most famous for losing, you know, and that obviously doesn't tell anything like the full story. But a lot of athletes, riders, egos would have a hard time dealing with that. He was there at the tour, you know, to his last year, as a famous kind of figure, but also as a sort of novelty in a way. How did he, was he reconciled to that? Was he at all bitter about these missed opportunities or the fact that he didn't ever win the tour, where he's clearly capable of it?
No, he was, there's two things, you know. I think he resented not wearing the jersey once. There's another anecdote where once, you know, after the career, they were, because they were really more than rivals. They were really a strong enmity, like Richard Freeman, Shane Sutton between Anquetil.
That's the great rivalry of today.
and Poulidor on their day. They really hated one another because, you know, there'd been very nasty moments between them. But they more than reconciled. They became good friends, you know, after they ended their career. And there's a story of a night when, Anquetil was a bon viveur, as you say in English, bon vivant, as we say in French, and other difference. But anyway, so they were at Anquetil's place and they got very drunk, and Anquetil insisted that Poulidor, you know, put on the yellow jersey, and Poulidor wouldn't. I said, no, it's, you know, I shouldn't do that. I mean, he kind of respected that jersey almost too much to wear it, and so I think he resented that. The problem is he was very unlucky in his career. Like in 1968, he was 2 days away from winning the tour when he got, you know, hit by a motorbike on the flat stage, and I mean, the tour was more than within grasp. He had won it, and many, many times like this. Lionel was mentioned in 1964, climbed up Puy de Dôme when he came 13 seconds short of the yellow jersey, and then he collapsed again the next day. I mean, 1965, the tour was actually for him. Anquetil was not riding it, and the last minute reinforcement in the Italian team, a young guy called Felice Di Mondi, should not have taken part in the tour. He won it. I mean, but I think that what makes it a real champion like Anquetil or Chris Froome, Eddy Merckx, I mean, the guys who did it is precisely that. You kind of make your own luck, and maybe Poulidor was not, you know, didn't have. He said many times, I probably would have made less, you know, money had I won the tour, even once, you know, that because my image was much stronger as the eternal second, and in the same time he was saying, okay, I also won a couple of races, but and more than a couple of races. But he said, you know, cycling brought me so much, you know, from where I started. Without cycling, I would have stayed in my village, being a farmer for forever. I would not have seen the world. I mean, it changed me completely. So why could I complain about my life? So I've never ever heard Pulido. I've met him many times. I never ever heard Pulido complain about anything, or about, you know, Anquetil being nasty, or about losing the tour. I mean, he accepted his fate, because I mean, his fate compared to where he started from was amazing already.
Well, I was just going to say, I like how you said he's most famous for coming second. The Dutch media today say he's most famous for being Matthew van der Poel's grandfather. So I like how they're sort of claiming him as one of their own. And it was the second story on Telegraph, De Telegraph, sports pages. And they're all playing up, I guess, that heritage that he's left behind in the lineage. And pointing out how great it was that he was able to witness the Amstel Gold this year, and that he was in Brussels for Mike Tournison having the yellow jersey and Jumbo Visma's fantastic early days in this Tour de France. And I just think it'll be wonderful to see, hopefully, Matthew van der Poel paying tribute to him over the next year. Certainly, I think the next race win, I would imagine, would be dedicated in his grandfather's honour, which would be lovely.
As we mentioned, because just to finish on that, I had the chance with you guys at Arrogate to interview Mathieu van der Poel. So I really had Mathieu van der Poel like you know, less than a meter away from me, and the similarity in their faces, it was absolutely striking. It was almost frightening, you know. So well, Pulido lives on.
But van der Poel seems to have a ruthless streak, perhaps, when it comes to racing that maybe his grandfather didn't have, because I think, you know what. The guy who was in the village every day at the tour, he never got bored or remotely resentful, it seemed to me, of being asked basically the same questions for 40 years about, you know, what was it like to be the eternal second. He must have been asked that every day in the village. And he you know, through that, he came across as quite a humble, down-to-earth, nice guy. Van der Poel has perhaps that ruthless streak that Anquetil had.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think Pulido was just a kind man. You know, and as I said before, I mean, quite controversially, you know, because, you know, I was saying Geraint Thomas can't win the Tour because he's a nice guy. But yeah, it's whatever. It's harder for nice guys to win the Tour. Jacques Anquetil was not a nice guy. Bernardino was not a nice guy. I don't think the guys who really go for it, real champions, who already think about the next wins. I think Pulido was more thinking about, well, it's, you know what it's like. He was called stingy, or, you know, doing this for money. But I mean, once again, when you've started as a poor guy in a poor family, can you be, you know, you shouldn't be ashamed of making money, and making maybe sometimes money more important than glory. I mean, Sean Kelly was also criticized for that. They belong to that kind of breed, you know. They really worked hard, come from very, very you know, difficult backgrounds, and I mean, what these guys, you know, that type of riders achieved is more than respectable. It's admirable.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And you can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com. Now, Orla looks like she's Instagramming. Are you, Orla?
how wonderfully perceptive of you, Richard.
Richard, she's putting me on the internet without my consent.
She's always doing that. It's par for the course. Now, a little bit of other news today. I think that Romain Bardet has been an early customer and has bought a copy of the Grand Tour Diaries, because in it, Francois writes about his poor Tour de France, his worst since 2013. And you write, Francois, if I may quote, since his pro debut, he only rode the Vuelta once and has yet to take part in the Giro. His consistently good results in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, his second places in Strade Bianche or at the Worlds in 2018, have shown what a versatile rider he could be without his Tour de France monomania. Bardet is a clever young man and will hopefully be able to reinvent himself as a cyclist and find new goals and motivations. The Tour might not be one of those. Ah, wonderfully prescient, Francois. And lo and behold, Bardet says he's going to ride the Giro next year, miss the Tour, and then ride the Olympic Games.
Yeah, I mean, it's clever. I mean, that as I also say in the book, I mean, there was a moment which is quite amazing, actually, when he actually called AG2R team manager Vincent Lavenue after last year's tour to say, that's it, I'm out of it, I'm quitting, I'm giving up cycling altogether, which is very strange for a guy who strived and worked so hard to... He really, I think there was a misconception from the start. He was misguided in a way. Well, he was second, so I think there's much more to Romain Bardet than just a tour contender. And I'm really, really happy to see him doing something completely different. As Lionel said, he's trained cyclocross. He's going to do the Giro.
500 meters of a cyclocross race.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, he might do a couple of others if he has the chance. He really wants to do something different. He's going to do the Giro. It was a disgrace that a rider of his talent, had never done it. He's doing the Vuelta again. In the meantime, the Olympics, so it's a very bumpy ride, and he likes these one-day races with a real goal to go for, and you know, the parkour suits him a lot. Same for the words. So, maybe the most clever program he's had since the start of his pro career. So let's expect good things from Bardet.
And I think with the Olympic road race coming so soon after the Tour de France, we might see a few other riders opt to take a similar approach to the Olympics, riding the Giro and the Olympic road race. I see Vincenzo Nibali is going to do that. Did I see that? He's Trek Segafredo now. I think he may well be following the same program. But it makes sense, doesn't it? It's going to be difficult to go to the Tour and a few days later contend for the Olympic road race.
I can only hope that the Giro attracts some big, exciting names next year, because it wasn't the most thrilling edition this year.
And it had all the big names this year, at least at the start.
That's true. It did. My fear for next year's year is the length of so many of those stages. It sort of fills me with a little bit of dread, if I'm honest. Not that I'll be saying that on the eve of the Giro. Of course, I'll bill it as the most exciting race that we're going to see in a long time. But with Bardet.
Well, just on that, Orla, I think that one of the things we were talking about, the contrast between the Giro and now the Tour and the Vuelta, seems to be a deliberate strategy of Mauro Venu to make, because his quote supporting the 2020 route of the Giro were that one of the Grand Tours has to be this extreme endurance test, and with 10 stages over 200 kilometres, it's certainly that. And I wonder, you know, Bardet is a bit of a diesel, isn't he? He doesn't mind long races. It could be that the challenge of the Giro suits him better than the pressure cooker of the Tour.
True, there are three time trials, though, which aren't Bardet's specialty, and I'm hoping that's a good thing, because if it was just decided on these long diesel necessary stages, then it would be quite dull. So I'm hoping those that those time trials will break things up a little bit. But you would imagine that that's where, for Bardet, he would have to have a little bit of caution. But it's nice to see new names coming to the Giro, at least.
Yeah, and the thing you said about this is, time trial is not his specialty, but I mean, some of them don't look so hard for him. And the last week is exactly the kind of stages he likes, long, difficult, with very long climbs. That's where he's best at. If he loses lots of time in the time trials, why do you go for stage wins and add lines to his record? And if he doesn't lose so much time, he'll be a force to reckon with in the third week. So anyway, he really needed to reinvent himself, and I think he's taking the right approach. If it doesn't pay off this season, he'll end up this season a new rider with new perspective, and that's what matters.
Any other riders listening are looking for tips, hints about how they should, what direction they should take their careers in? Lots more words like that from Francois in the Grand Tour Diaries. Available now, not in all good bookshops. Available from thecyclingpodcast.com. I should mention before we go as well that our final Friends Special 2019 has been released this week. It's a two-parter, and it's one of our guest-edited episodes. William Martino, one of our listeners, who very generously supports the Cycling Podcast with a bit of extra money each year, as a few of you do. You all submitted ideas. William's was great. It was about how to create a team culture, given the unique challenges of professional cycling. Brings in some of his own working experiences into the episode, and we hear quite a lot from De Koenig, Quickstep, and also from Rod Ellingworth, about how he's going to try and create a winning culture at Bahrain Merida. That's out now for friends of the podcast, and we'll be launching 2020 quite soon.
We will indeed, with a new delivery system, which promises to be a lot easier for people to operate than the system that we have persevered with over the years. We've had lots of comments over the years about why the Friends of the Podcast paywall is slightly clunky for some people to operate. Well, the reason for that is we're not quite as big as Amazon. We haven't yet developed that sort of technology, and it doesn't actually exist, or it hasn't existed. So we've had to kind of go looking for it, and we think we found a solution which hopefully will make it a lot easier for people to sign up and listen to their 2020 episodes of Friends of the Podcast. I should also give an early warning that at some point the 2015 to 2019 material will come offline, and we'll give plenty of notice of that, but people will at some point have to download any episodes they want to save, and we may well put a kind of best of collection on the new system, but we haven't quite gone into all the details on that yet, but we will do before Christmas, I think.
Well, folks, we better get ready for Huntingdon Hall in Worcester. Go and have get ready, get warmed up, do your vocal exercises.
I'm probably going to do a little siesta before that, but
well, thanks very much for joining us, Francois, and there are still tickets available for our shows in Belfast, very nearly sold out, but London on the 18th, London on the 25th, Cambridge on the 26th, Edinburgh on the 27th, that's also very nearly sold out, Leicester on the 28th, and Manchester on the 30th. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Orla.
Thank you very much.
And happy birthday. Play out with...
Bon anniversaire, Orla.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.